It's time to turn off the lights and turn on the dark.
Chilling tales for dark nights.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to another episode of Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. I'm your host, Steve Taylor, and tonight we're crossing into a place where childhood memories refuse to stay buried, where old friendships become tangled in guilt and regret, and where some paths remain just as dangerous decades later as they were the first time they were traveled. Tonight's story follows one man whose happiest childhood memories become inseparable from his darkest nightmares. What begins as an innocent adventure between friends eventually grows into something far more unsettling, and where the lines between superstition and reality begin to blur. Now, turn down the lights, settle in, and get cozy. The show is about to begin. Tonight's featured tale of terror comes to us courtesy of author Eli Pope and is performed by Paul J. McSorley. Without further ado, I present to you The Pipe Bridge.
1. The thumping inside my chest pounded in a rapid cadence, not skipping a beat. I swear it felt harder and deeper with every slide of my knee drug across the rough and aging concrete encasement. Both sides of the ledge were separated by the iron half-pipe nestled tightly into the concrete bridge work my butt sat perched upon. As each knee scooted forward, it was mere inches from spilling over the side into the abyss below. I had gone too far. I couldn't make myself turn around. My body refused to back up to where I'd climbed on to start my journey. There was no looking down now that I'd passed the rocky bluff the pipe bridge jutted out from. I knew I had to continue to the other side of the deep hollow canyon leading past the river below, the deep waters of the Petit Jean. I remember the first time I saw the pipe bridge. I wondered what could possibly be carried within the iron pipe that crossed over the river. My best friend Charlie led the way as we carefully scooted across the long passage, small increments with each movement of our knees followed by a butt scoot across the pipe. He told me about the hidden place we could sanction as our secret hideaway fort, just the other side of the river, secluded from sight inside an area surrounded by a forest of strange white-barked twisted trees. Charlie told me about the ground underneath the canopy of tree branches covered in magic moss-like carpet that felt cool and squishy on one's bare feet. He called the place enchanted and told me no one in the world knew of its existence except him. I was only 7 years old, he having recently turned 8. I believed every word he spoke as if it were gospel. When we finally did cross to the other side and climb down the rocky bluff, we entered a hidden path into that magical forest, and I realized he had indeed told me the truth. It was beautiful. It was bright green, both serene and eerie, as the wind whistled whimsical tunes through the tree limbs and swept through the fragrant space enclosed within. While I dreaded the trip back across the water-filled canyon, I knew I'd be making the pipe bridge crawl many times throughout my childhood years. I knew my parents would ban me from such activity if I ever told them. I also knew Charlie would never forgive me for giving our spot away to anyone from the outside. The first trip back across that afternoon was almost worse than the first passage coming over. This time I took a chance by moving my focus from looking at the half-pipe leading my way and instead down to each side of the danger leering below. It felt like hundreds of feet. No, thousands of feet below to the river water and rocks. Looking back now, I realize it was more likely only 20 or 30 feet, but still enough to kill a 7-year-old if he fell into its vastness. It wasn't the part of this pilgrimage traversing above the water of the river that scared me the most. It was the small rocky island sitting almost halfway between the world of Charlie's secret magical place we were leaving and the entrance into our parents' world filled with their protection. I knew those jagged rocks below were deadly. I also noticed the dark crevasse that sat dead center of the island, the black trench Charlie called Hell's Gate. At only 7, I held no clue how my friend knew such things. But he had proven his honesty about his secret place with his descriptions matching what I saw exactly. I knew I didn't want or need to question his knowledge about Hell's Gate. I wanted no part of that. I only knew from that day on I was most scared during each crossing when I slowly slid precariously over the dark, thick hole between the large, jagged rocks. I always took my time and slowly maneuvered each rough-skinned knee along the concrete rough edge, which quickly forced the thick calluses on my kneecaps, replacing the once thin soft skin residing there before. 2. My story could probably end with those childhood memories of my growing up and spending every single summer day with my best friend Charlie Wallace in our tiny little town of Pontoon, Arkansas, near the Petit Jean River in Conway County, if not for one important detail. Becky Shea Cahill, the new move-in from a faraway place called California. Well now, Rowdy, this is an interesting addition to your story. I don't believe you've ever mentioned a girl before, have you? No, Doc, I have not mentioned her before. She was a real beauty of a young girl, but a truly dark spot within the story. What are the rules of you being able to repeat any of the things I tell you? Protected? Rowdy questioned. That's a great question, Rowdy. The notes I have containing our conversations are strictly confidential. A court could possibly use a warrant to obtain them, but I write very scant notes for just that reason. I consider our conversations as treatment to aid in your mental health recovery and have no intent on ever sharing such information with anyone, not family nor law enforcement. I suppose you will have to put your faith in my word that I believe enough in my profession that I will keep that promise to you. Rowdy, your mental health is my priority. Do you trust me when I tell you this? I do, Doc. I know I need help. I feel a deep pounding thunder inside my heart, just about as booming as that day I turned 9. A little less rapid, of course. Most likely because of my age now. I'm 58, you know? But my blood still pumps through these tired old veins in such a way it fills my body with crippling anxiety and fear. Rowdy's eyes became fixed. His face and ears began to redden. I suppose I've got no choice other than let the pressure build till I blow a gasket and it seizes my heart and brain up. But that wouldn't help me or Becky now, would it? So, I'll just say you are an honest doctor who will help me kill this demon inside my head. No, Rowdy, your heart or head seizing up would not help anyone. I'm glad we now have this trust between us. I think we can make major breakthroughs in your condition if we proceed such as we have already. I'm ready to tell you everything, Doc. I can't go on any longer this way. It's been far too long already. You're my last patient for the day. How about we just skip paying any attention to the clock this session and just keep going until it feels right stopping? Is that okay with you? Double time? You know my finances, surely. Let's not worry about the cost. Let's get the heart rate of yours slowed down to a manageable speed, Rowdy. Well, okay, Doc. 3. Becky Shea was my first and only crush, Doc. In fact, after all this time, I think it must have been true love. I still remember how her blonde curls in her hair caught my attention the first time she was escorted into Mrs. Rice's second grade class I attended. Principal Reaney opened the door and introduced her to my teacher, and I swear I heard the clatter of melodic wind chimes throughout the classroom. I knew I felt something I had never felt before, and I was instantly drawn into its clutches. It felt like a magic spell had been cast upon my heart. So it's been, what, a couple of years now at this point since you'd started crossing the pipe bridge to your and Charlie's spot? Yeah, it was almost old hat making the crossing there and back by this time. Memory muscle, really. I could do it with my eyes shut, or I could watch the world below it. The cliff, the water, the island, even Hell's Gate. Rowdy spoke with a calmness in his voice. If only things had stopped there at that point. That old adage, woulda, coulda, shoulda. Doc guffawed as if he had understood regret. That's right, Doc. You see, though, I'm sure that things didn't just end there. The tone changed in Rowdy's voice. It tightened and became curt. I should never have suggested to Becky Shea that she come with me. Never. Rowdy's breathing became elevated in volume, and the sound of painful sighs escaped his lips as he exhaled. Do we need to stop a minute? I can pour you a Coke or a cup of coffee, ice water. No, Doc. I just need to power through it, I think. Well, take a breather anytime you need to. There's no ticking of the time clock this evening. I'm here to see if we can get this out of your head once and for all. I appreciate that. I'm just glad you haven't wanted to just sedate me with meds like all the other doctors have. I won't say that medicines don't have their place. I just think we need to see if we can bypass them as long as we can and heal with understanding the whys we sometimes suffer from our experiences and let them rule us. Those words alone are a godsend, Doc. We're building trust between us, Rowdy. That's the first step in solving these problems. Trust. Well, Doc, like I was saying, I shouldn't have invited Becky Shea, but I did. Rowdy's calmness began to sink back into an obvious tightness. I thought Charlie would be okay with me bringing her across the bridge. I never even thought to ask him. He liked Becky Shea too, or at least he seemed to. The three of us would sit together at lunch most of the time. Hell, she even liked to play softball with us out on the playground after lunch and during recess. She really wasn't a girly girl. More like a tomboy, really. Rowdy seemed to travel back in time within his mind, pausing briefly for reflection before continuing his story. There was one aspect I never even thought of about our little triangle friendship. One Charlie never told me or hinted at to me. Rowdy guffawed quietly as if he had just received an epiphany. Doc, I'll be damned if Charlie didn't have the same feelings of puppy love for Becky Shea as I did. He never told me, but the look on his face when he saw her walking beside me through the tight opening and cover between the tree limbs. He stopped again and then looked straight into Doc's eyes. I saw red in Charlie's eyes. He was jealous as could be. Rowdy, what was her experience exhibiting as you both made the trek across the pipe bridge? Fear like you felt your first time? She was like an old pro, Doc. Never cried out or asked me to slow down or stop. In fact, she said the river looked beautiful from up above, like staring down from heaven at a slice of God's gift, if I remember correctly. Rowdy smiled warmly before continuing. She was the perfect girl, Doc. Beauty, smarts, brave as a charging bull, but being around her felt relaxing as a warm bath. Do you know what I mean? I think I do, Rowdy. You've been very descriptive in all your story. You have an uncanny ability to paint the picture so vividly. I feel like I was one of your friends who was there with you, living in your childhood as a good friend. Yeah, Doc, that's funny you say because I feel the same way. Ready for a Coke or a coffee break yet? No, I think I'm fine. All right, so Charlie didn't seem happy to see you two? At first, I couldn't tell by just his eyes. It was more in the way he said Becky Shea's name. Like he was surprised, but was mixed in with anger for the both of us. It wasn't even his words, just the tone in his voice and then the color change in his eyes and face. Do you remember what he said? As close to exact as possible. Charlie's eyes were glossed over and kind of droopy or lazy and dark. I can picture him right now as if he were standing in front of us. I mean, me. Rowdy's voice quivered a bit. He asked me, "Why did you have to bring Becky Shea? You didn't ask if it was okay with me?" He paused. "I didn't think you'd care, Charlie. You like her okay, don't you?" Rowdy began having a one-sided conversation as if he could hear how Charlie was responding, but Charlie's half of the conversation was silent to the room. "I thought so. That's why I brought her. She's more like one of us than anybody else, Charlie. She won't tell anyone else. She already promised me." Rowdy stood up from the couch and began nervously pacing the confines of the room. "Come on, Charlie, don't be like that. I know it's only yours and my place, but it's time to have other club members, don't you think? We're the Three Musketeers. You've said it yourself." He stopped pacing. "What? What do you mean you like her too?" Rowdy turned to his right and continued talking as if Becky were next to him. "Who do you like best, Becky Shea? Me or Charlie?" Rowdy paused as if he were awaiting her to answer. "No, don't say that. What do you mean? Why didn't you tell me ahead of time? I wouldn't have ever brought you here. I'm in love with you, Becky Shea. I've never felt..." "Never mind. You and Charlie can just have each other." Rowdy took several steps across the office and then dropped quickly to his knees and began crawling as if he were on the pipe bridge, quickly scooting away. He looked back. "Don't follow me, Becky Shea. I'm not coming back. Ever." He turned back forward and continued carefully crawling. He suddenly stopped and twisted back, facing behind him. "It's okay, Becky Shea. Stay there. I'll turn around and help you. Just hang on." He slowly began to turn as if he were carefully maintaining his balance. "I've almost got it." Rowdy paused and then began shaking before he rolled off to the side and onto his back, flailing his arms and legs, yelling, "Becky Shea!" As quickly as he rolled off and over to his back, he became still as a rock. His arms and legs twisted into positions on the office floor that appeared unnatural and painful. The office became deafeningly silent. Doc slowly got up and walked over to where Rowdy lay quietly, his eyes shut and completely still. He knelt and touched Rowdy's arm and lightly shook it. "Rowdy, you're okay, buddy." Rowdy's eyes began to twitch before they slowly opened. His arms wriggled and he grumbled in a pained tone. His eyes darted back and forth before traveling up and meeting Doc's. "Charlie?" His pupils appeared dilated for a moment and then appeared to adjust in focus like a camera lens. "Is Becky Shea okay? I saw her. I fell and she reached out and then she fell too." "You're okay, Rowdy. Becky Shea is okay too." Doc continued to pat Rowdy's arm. "I saw her, though. She fell into the abyss of Hell's Gate. I saw her. I crawled over and looked inside. I saw the hand, the long claws." "It's okay, Rowdy. I promise Becky Shea is just fine." "She can't be. It's all my fault. The hand, it grabbed her when I reached in to try and help." Rowdy's eyes flooded with tears. "I tried to save her, Charlie. The devil pulled her away from me and into this darkness. I couldn't. I tried to climb over the edge and..." Doc began to lightly shake Rowdy's shoulder again, this time with a little more force. He looked over toward his office door as a silhouette appeared in the frosted glass panel. "I'm sore, Charlie. I tried. I'm sorry." The doorknob slowly rotated counterclockwise before a click of the latch allowed the door to begin swinging open. The figure slowly peeked around from the door before stepping into the office. "Charlie?" the female voice called out. "Are you in here?" Her hand reached for the wall, her fingers trailing across until they touched the light switch. "Becky, don't turn the light on just yet."
"What's going on, Charlie?"
she called out in question.
"It's late. I was worried. Are you okay?"
"I'm with Rowdy."
"Rowdy Bugner? From Pontoon Elementary?"
She continued to quietly step further into Charlie's office. "He's a patient. He's in here on the floor. You should probably leave." Rowdy moved and attempted to lift his head towards her voice. "Becky Shea? Is that you?" Rowdy's body tensed. "Is that really you? You're alive?" Doc squeezed Rowdy's arm tighter and leaned in. "It's okay, Rowdy. It's Becky. She's just fine." He then turned to Becky and motioned with his head for her to step in closer. He then quietly made a shushing sound to cue her in to coming in quietly. "Becky Shea is alive and well, Rowdy. Can you sit up?"
I don't understand, Doc. What's going on? She fell just after I fell, and..."
"Rowdy, you did fall, and Becky fell too, but that was a long time ago, friend."
But I saw the slimy hand with long claws. It pulled her away where I couldn't reach her to save her. It was my fault. She followed me across that damn pipe bridge."
"I'm okay, Rowdy. We both lived through that accident."
"That's what it was, Rowdy. Nobody's fault. It was an unfortunate accident,"
Becky answered with an almost whispered hushed tone. "She's right, Rowdy. You both survived the accident. That was almost 50 years ago, my friend."
"What? Then where have I been all this time? I can't believe Hell's Gate was real.
I'm sorry, Rowdy. I should never have told you that name and scary story. It's all my fault. All these years, it's been all my fault."
"But where have I been if that's true?"
"We're all here in my office, Rowdy. I'm a doctor here. We're at the Conway County Mental Sanitarium," Charlie replied.
"Where? What for 50 years?
"I'm sorry, Rowdy. I truly am very, very sorry.
My life has all just been a dream? A nightmare?"
Rowdy struggled to get up, his body now tensed and stiff.
"But you and Becky Shea are still here?"
I couldn't just leave you."
"Rowdy, you're my best friend," Doc answered. "It's all been my fault. I thought you were dead that day, both of you."
"Take me there, Charlie."
"Where, Rowdy?"
"The pipe bridge. I want to see our spot again."
It doesn't look like it used to, Rowdy. "I need to see it. Is the pipe bridge still there? Does it still cross the Petit Jean?"
"I haven't been there for years, Rowdy. I couldn't make myself go back. I've not been there for over 40-some years," Doc Charlie replied.
"I haven't either, Rowdy," Becky echoed. "Please, Charlie, my entire life has been trapped in that spot. I have to see it to put it behind me. I'm begging you."
"I don't know, Rowdy.
You owe me, Charlie. I don't want to put it like... But you owe me that much."
Charlie looked over at Becky Shea.
"I think we should. Should all three go?" Becky Shea replied.
4. Charlie had been correct. The area had changed considerably.
neighborhoods now adorn the area alongside the river and gorge that once was only wooded forests and weeds. They parked on a circle drive that held a path down to the rocky bluff where the pipe bridge still stretched outward over the edge and then across the stretch of a small channel of the Petite Jean River. The rocky island still rested underneath that bridge about halfway across, the spot where Rowdy's life became encapsulated in a mental jar of sorts for almost 50 years. Rowdy's eyes panned out across the horizon that fit nestled tightly between two large multi-level homes overlooking the Petite Jean River and the old, now dilapidated pipe bridge. The sun gleamed across the rolling river as the three reunited friends slowly made their way down a weed-covered path to the spot the cement-encased pipe left the rocky covering and stretched outward away from solid ground on scattered pylons, reaching the surface of the water before disappearing below it. He looked back at Charlie and Becky Shea as he slowly straddled the pipe, his much older legs wrapping tightly on either side of the half-pipe protruding above the concrete encasement. He looked back with an odd gleam in his eyes before he began sliding one knee forward and then the other. Once he got about 10 feet over the rocky edge, he turned back again and saw his best friend Charlie helping Becky Shea onto the pipe. Homeowners began clamoring out onto their decks once they noticed three older adults scooting across the old landmark bridge. They turned and spoke from across one deck to the other, but it was all just jumbled hollering to the three people now almost halfway across the bridge. The sound of the river's movement mixing with the sounds of the residents in the background created an odd, eclectic, muffled mix. Rowdy looked off to his left, where the forest once stood tall with twisted white-barked trees covering Charlie's and his hideout. Those trees now all gone, making Rowdy's memory feel foggy and discombobulated. The familiarity of the moment now slipped away like the years between back then and now had done. Years vanished in an instant. He glanced behind him, seeing his best friend moving slowly behind the girl. The only girl he had ever fallen in love with. That once beautiful time in his childhood awoken to a truth of being stolen and then turned into a lifetime of guilt and remorse. He looked down below as he sat perched directly above Hellgate's dark opening in the earth. In this small flicker of his life, he suddenly felt the fear that distant moment he had tried to reach for Becky Shea's hand to save her from the devil hiding inside the shadows. A small tear formed perfectly in the corner of each eye, as if it had taken 50 long years to crystallize and perfect the tiny glistening drops of liquid now adorning his face. Had his best friend betrayed him? He never asked the question, which had immediately formed in his brain, but he noticed the matching rings on each of their fingers. It immediately caused a painful sting in his heart upon realizing his best friend must have ended up with the love of his life while he remained trapped in a horrible replaying nightmare, his sweet dreams stolen while he remained helpless and unaware. The devil obviously letting go of Becky's hand, releasing her to Charlie and instead grabbing hold of his, pulling him into a darkened, unending world he thought he had escaped. Rowdy's legs began to tremble without control. He felt a shimmy in the old brittle concrete structure as it rumbled below his knees. The pipe he sat on began growing hot to his butt as if boiling water were beginning to flow inside the round iron interior. He lifted himself up onto his knees, which now had grown in size with time and age, now large enough to overhang the edges of the flat rough concrete edges. He lifted one hand which had helped stabilize his body's precarious perch so he could twist and look back behind him once again to his friends from his past, the ones who betrayed him. They appeared to feel nothing of the heat or rumble within the structure that held them hovering above the rocky island in the middle of the Petite Jean River. Charlie and Becky Shea continued to make their way closer to Hell's Gate and their old friend. Rowdy began to return his gaze away and back to the ground below, causing his balance to teeter. His loose hand reached forward, attempting to latch on to anything his fingers could grasp as the bridge began to rattle and shake beneath him. He lost his balance and fell over the side, catching the rough concrete edge with his fingers. Feet dangling, swinging back and forth from the momentum of the fall tugged at his fingers, and they began slipping as his knuckles became whiter by the second. Tiny pieces of cement began to break away from under his grip. Becky screamed out, "Rowdy, hang on!" He turned and saw the fright in her face as Charlie struggled to lean past her enough to see what was happening.
"Hang on, Rowdy!" Charlie yelled.
There were screams from the residents' decks as they watched helplessly while Rowdy's body hung from the bridge's crumbling ledge. Rowdy looked over at Becky Shea one last time, mouthing the words, "I love you," before glancing back down to Hell's Gate, which seemed to be calling his name to come home. His fingers straightened out as the concrete crumbled into dust, forcing his free fall into the dark chasm below. Becky Shea and Charlie watched helplessly as Rowdy disappeared into the black hole, unable to witness the clawed fist snatch Rowdy into its clutches and quickly pull him into his grip, forever disappearing into the darkness of the gate into Hell's Entrance. Rowdy's body was never recovered, and Becky Shea and her husband Charlie never spoke another word about any of what happened after the case was closed on Rowdy Lee Williams. Charlie did answer the call from the state's warrant to turn over his notebook on Rowdy's treatment for the almost 50 years he had spent under the care of the Conway County Mental Sanitarium. The notes were very sparse, and Charlie claimed patients' privacy beyond the notes, never answering questions asked. He eventually lost his license to practice care in the medical field in the state of Arkansas, and he and his wife, Becky Shea, moved to a small town on Florida's Forgotten Coast upon his forced retirement. Neighbors of homes within sight of the pipe bridge still standing over Hell's Gate profess to hear a voice they claim are of Rowdy Lee calling out to his childhood love, Becky Shea Cahill. To this very day and night, the moon saturates the sky with its round glowing fullness. The words, "I love you, Becky Shea," can be heard whispering through the pylons of the pipe bridge near the small town of Pontoon, Arkansas.
You've just heard The Pipe Bridge, written by Eli Pope, as performed by Paul J. McSorley and produced by Nikki McSorley. In The Pipe Bridge, Eli Pope explored how childhood memories could become prisons when they were shaped by grief, guilt, and unanswered questions. For Rowdy, a secret refuge that had once represented freedom and adventure slowly transformed into the place where his entire life became frozen in time. Whether the horrors he remembered were born from trauma, something supernatural lurking beneath Hell's Gate, or some unsettling combination of the two, the consequences proved just as devastating. The story also blurred the line between memory and reality in a way that never demanded a single explanation. Rowdy spent decades convinced he had witnessed an unspeakable evil, claiming someone he loved, while Charlie carried the burden of knowing that a tragic accident had destroyed his best friend's life in ways he could never fully repair. By allowing both perspectives to exist side by side, the story invited us to wonder whether some nightmares survived because they were real, or because believing them became easier than accepting the truth. If you enjoyed Paul J. McSorley's performance this evening, you'll be pleased to know there are hundreds more waiting for you. As one of the most engaging storytellers in horror audio today, Paul has earned a loyal following through his natural delivery, memorable character work, and remarkable ability to balance heartfelt emotion with steadily building suspense. Whether bringing small-town legends to life, guiding listeners through psychological nightmares, or recounting eerie tales of the unexplained, Paul's performances continue to captivate audiences episode after episode. Paul is also the host of Fear from the Heartland, a long-running horror podcast here on the Chilling Entertainment Network. Now in its seventh season, the series has delivered hundreds of episodes, exploring supernatural folklore, chilling mysteries, eerie encounters, and unforgettable horror stories from across America's heartland and beyond. If you enjoyed Paul's storytelling tonight, we encourage you to check out Fear from the Heartland, available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, Rumble, and wherever else you get your favorite podcasts. With hundreds of episodes already available, there's no shortage of unforgettable stories still waiting to keep you awake at night. Before we close tonight's episode, I'd like to extend a heartfelt thank you to everyone who supports Chilling Tales for Dark Nights through our exclusive patrons area. For just $7.99 a month, you'll receive ad-free versions of every episode, early access to new releases, exclusive bonus content, and unlimited access to our ever-expanding library of premium material. Annual memberships are also available at a discounted rate, offering even greater value while helping us continue bringing new nightmares to life week after week. Your membership directly supports every aspect of our productions, making it possible for our talented writers, narrators, producers, composers, artists, editors, and the many dedicated people working behind the scenes to continue creating the immersive horror experiences you've come to expect from us. Whether you've been listening since our earliest episodes or you've only recently discovered Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, we're grateful to have you as part of our community. Your support means more than words can express, and we're honored to continue sharing these stories with you. To learn more or to become a patron today, visit ChillingTalesForDarkNights.com. On behalf of everyone here at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, thank you for spending part of your evening with us. I'm Steve Taylor, and it's been my pleasure to be your host. If you enjoyed tonight's episode, we'd love to hear what you thought. Leave us a comment, follow the show wherever you can, and if your favorite podcast platform allows it, please consider leaving us a rating or review. Those simple gestures go a long way toward helping more horror fans discover the stories we love bringing to life each week. And if you know someone who enjoys psychological horror, haunting rural legends, unsettling supernatural mysteries, or stories where childhood memories refuse to stay buried, be sure to share tonight's episode with them. You might just introduce them to their next favorite nightmare. For even more terrifying fiction, visit creepypastastories.com. And don't forget to follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights across social media for news about upcoming episodes, exclusive announcements, live events, and everything else happening behind the scenes. You'll find us on Facebook, X, Instagram, TikTok, Rumble, and YouTube. Until next time, turn off the lights and turn on the dark. Sweet dreams, listeners. Sweet dreams.